Okay, the background for my talk arose out of a Foundation for Research, Science and Technology funded program called Future Foods, which is a social science-based program where Partner Food Research is working with ESR Limited social scientists to look at a range of futuristic food technologies and then have a look at whether those food technologies are likely to raise social, cultural or environmental issues and what the frameworks around those strategic issues might be. And then for each technology, having a look at how this sort of the economic, the social and the cultural and environmental issues might inform early decision making around those technologies. And then that would then apply, we can apply our learning to facilitate uptake and also guide science strategy in looking at that, those technologies amongst the government, the funding, the people who fund us, the science sector and the food industry itself. We, as part of that program, we did some scoping reports which discussed key trends in selected future technologies. And we also had a look at how to the future and how the applications of those technology might arise. And after looking at a snapshot of trends and assessing the issues, how might those be related to the potential applications? And one of the things that is quite clear, at least in terms of the nanotechnology that I'm about to talk about, is that much of the future is already here, and it's out there in the agri-food chain. In terms of nanotechnology and agri-food, a definition of nanotechnology that's generally accepted, apart from the extra words that are in my statement, is that it's the application of science at scales of less than 100 nanometers. And just to get some perspective, one nanometer is a millionth of a millimeter. Having said that, there is plenty of stretch, I guess, in what people call nanotechnology. And you'll see some instances, some examples that I give later, where that could be sort of stretched out to structures of around 300 nanometer dimensions. And one of the reasons for that, I guess, is amongst this first megatrend that I've identified, and that there's plenty of hype out there, and it's Alan McDiarmid, the New Zealand, or late New Zealand, Nobel laureate, said, "Nano is Greek for funding at that present." The world's biggest food companies are active in the technology, and it's estimated that more than 600 foods and more than 500 food packaging applications are already utilising nanotechnology in one form or another. To give you some idea of the growth, in the next bullet point you can see that there are estimates in the packaging sector from something in the less of the order of $1 billion worth in 2004, trebling by 2012. However, I guess it's fair to say, after looking through some of the what is out there, that much of the technology that we're nanotechnology that we're seeing in relation to food and the food industry is a downsizing of what we're already familiar with, and I guess that's similar to the computing industry in that respect. This is a kind of an applications tree that we drew up in terms of the looking at potential applications and thinking about them in respect to the agri-food chain, where we have the roots that are kind of the convergence of the food industry with nanotechnology. And I've classified the three areas as being on-farm, in-food and around food, and I'll address each of those in turn as I go through my talk. Examples on the farm. Maybe even pre-farm when we're talking about nanogenetics, it's all about plant breeding programs in terms of nanogenetics. But one of the current applications is using gold nanoparticles to take bits of DNA into cells when people are doing a shotgun approach to plant transformations. And that's really a stretch of a decades-old method by plant scientists to transform plants and get new genetic variants. And it literally is a shotgun approach. You fire these particles into the cells and hope that some of the DNA gets carried in and shows up as a change in the plant's characteristics. There are other examples we are looking at over the horizon. DNA injection into cell nuclei via carbon nanofibers has been proposed. Probably one of the more common areas are the nano-formulated agrochemicals. And Friends of the Earth, who I have drawn on in terms of examples for a number of examples in this talk, they cite examples where companies like Syngenta are probably reducing the particle size of their existing agrochemicals, emulsions, and one of the reasons for that is an increase in effectiveness, and we'll see examples of that where that principle is being applied to human nutrition as well. Another over-the-horizon possibility is nanosensors. This kind of, I guess, builds on the mention of nanorobots yesterday. And that is possible to deploy across a farm little devices that might monitor soil temperature, pH, nutrient levels and moisture, those sorts of things. That sort of technology is actually possible now at a macro or micro scale rather than running to nanotechnology where these things aren't possible yet. In terms of implications for food safety and the environment, and right through the talk I'll mention the environment because there are a lot of issues or potential issues. In terms of nanogenetics, well, the little gold particles that are used to transform plant cells are not going to be carried over into the offspring, they'll just stay in the original tissues. But there are implications there in terms of, well, if these nanoparticles are in the soil for whatever reason, and tissue growth medium that they're used to grow new plants or agricultural systems, are they taken up by the plants? And Plant Food Research has been doing a little bit of work around that to see if these things go up through the root systems into plants. In terms of nano-formulated agrochemicals, there are the same potential residual issues as for conventional formulations. There's no change in that. But we could think that and be optimistic that increased efficacy would also mean decreased use of these chemicals that are applied on farm. And having said all that, in the area of pesticides in particular, there is the potential for current technologies to be overtaken anyway, particularly with a new double-stranded RNA technology that's now being researched and is being touted in New Scientist as being highly applicable to insect control, and so that may supplant current chemical use for controlling insects. And nanosensors, we've got pie in the sky at the moment, and also you could ask the question of what advantages would they convey to compared to current micro and macro systems. But if that technology was possible, would there be soil, water and food contamination issues? Now we start on a fairly hefty section on what's possible in food and what is currently out there in food. And I think it's really important to point out that cow's milk is a very, very good example of where we have a natural beverage that contains nanomicelles. The casein micelles are in the order of 90 to 100 nanometers, so they fit within that nanotechnology definition. So cows have been doing it for a few thousand years, and we've been drinking the milk happily. Having said that, that doesn't mean to say that because something is natural, that it's necessarily good, and every new system needs to be looked at in a different context. Other examples are synthetic lycopene, coenzyme Q10, vitamins A, E, D, and K that have been the fat-soluble vitamins and polyunsaturated fatty acids being delivered in nano-formulations in the order of 300 nanometers. And these have been on the market for about 30 years, according to BASF's website. Aquanova make these 30 nanometer water soluble micelles that they tout as being carrier systems for hydrophobic substances. And these allow higher and faster intestinal and dermal absorption and penetration of the active ingredients, whether they're things like citric and benzoic acids, vitamins and soy, isoflavones, etc., and lutein, which is probably what I need, otherwise I wouldn't need these glasses. Another one is sun active iron. Its particle size is around 300 nanometers, and that's a complex between a protein and iron. And that's used in these milks for kids' nutrition. In terms of food safety and the environment, these nano options in my cells are being seen as a means of increasing the effect of essential nutrients. For example, Synactive Iron helps the little ones to meet their daily requirements for vitamins, minerals and protein. There's a nano-formulated vitamin E that says it delivers 10 times the adult recommended daily allowance. But the question I have to ask is, and I think you've probably already picked up on it, is the potential for potent bioavailability and how that might lead to delivering excessive doses. And I think that is a major, major concern. Excessive vitamins A and B6, for example, can be toxic. Folic acid can be toxic if we have too much of it. And the other question to ask is that the consumers that can afford these fancy products, because they do come with a price premium, do they actually need them? It's the people who can't afford them who probably most need them. Other examples in food, there's the current mania amongst some sectors of the population for nano-silver health supplements. They're a cure-all for everything. Nanoscale silicon may be a potential nutrient for bone health, and that's come out in a paper recently in the last 3 or 4 years. And things like titanium and zinc oxides that are currently allowed in foods as whiteness and brightness, there's the potential for those to be used at the nanoscale, as you may have seen in recent reports about the cosmetics industry. In the Netherlands and in New Zealand, we're actively looking at dairy and egg proteins and the structures that proteins self-assemble themselves into in high-protein foods. And in particular, people like to manipulate these structures, use proteins for things like texture enhancement. So getting nice gel structures makes the food yummy to eat. And what we want to look at is whether a range of these structures occur in other protein-rich foods that we're already processing and eating. Inorganic additives like nano-silver as health supplements. There seem to be few toxicity issues with nano-silver. You do read examples of people turning bluey-grey if they do drink too much of this stuff, but it doesn't really kill anybody. But then we have to ask the question of what happens to the silver in wastewater treatment and in estuarine environments, for example. If people are using washing machines that are producing this nano-silver stuff, how does that end up in the environment? And if it is such a potent antimicrobial, what's that doing to the probiotic gut flora that we have in our intestines and gut systems? And what does that do to nutrient uptake? Zinc and titanium dioxide, again, are probably benign, and are not used in many foods, but you look for E171 if you want to find titanium dioxide, and you'll find that in your mayonnaises and icing sugars and stuff like that, and icings. Titanium dioxide loves to react with polyphenolics and a number of the phytochemicals that we eat, the coloured substances in our food. So again, if those chemical reactions are taking place in our gut systems, what does that do to phytochemical bioavailability, and could it potentially affect our health? In terms of the nanostructures, a number of these occur under conditions of low pH and heating. There's a continuum of different sorts of structures that range from rod-like nanotubes through to worm, big wavy worm structures. And some of these are highly resistant proteolysis, so they don't get digested in the gut. Cytotoxicity may be an issue for some of the early precursors of some of these structures, particularly the rod-like nanotubes. And so we're actively exploring if any of these structural extremes occur in current food manufacturing processes. Other in-food examples are nanoencapsulation using inert food-grade materials like silicon and titanium magnesium oxides, subject of a recent US patent. And these are looked at as means of delivering encapsulated additives and nutrients. Other things that might emerge are the masking of bitter flavours of bioactives like phytochemicals, and these this could be used in fortified products and allow for non-release until the food or the active component is well inside the stomach. And I'll show you in a minute a good example, maybe, or a good reason for doing that. But doesn't necessarily have to involve nanotechnology. Another one might be to use a microwaves to disintegrate encapsulated flavours or colours and release them so you can't go and interact with food. As I just mentioned, using nanoencapsulation to mask a bit of flavours of some bioactives for targeted gut release could be a real positive in the war on obesity. And an example of that might be the design of foods for appetite control, and plant food and Auckland University and are about to embark on a research program called Foods for Appetite Control, in which we look at the different components of food and what triggers the satiety mechanisms, and there's a number of different mechanisms. And can we design foods that incorporate knowledge about those satiety mechanisms to design new foods where people start feeling full after eating just a little bit and they stay full, feeling full for up to 4 hours? And is there any risk from too much of a good thing? So if we've got better efficacy and uptake of these ingredients and these nutrients, can we overdose? And that, I guess, raises the issue about benchmarking research needed in what is normal ingestion and uptake on current diets. So we've got some sort of measure of how the increased efficacy of some of these new formulations could affect our nutrition and our well-being. In terms of microwaves to disintegrate encapsulated flavours, one concept was an interactive food or beverage where the consumer could dial the flavour or colour by changing the microwave frequency. But I think the people who proposed that overlooked the fact that most of the microwaves operate at only one frequency, and only two domestic microwave frequencies are allowed. Although I suppose it could be nice, especially if you use your cell phone to set off a different colour in your, TV dinner in the evening. It could be a useful concept for the consumer to regenerate fresh baked flavours and to make up for volatile flavour loss during transport, distribution and storage. Now we'll start talking a bit about around food applications, and most of these would fall under the general description of food contact materials. So we have things like active packaging, sensing, storage and kitchenware. One of the promises, I guess, of nanotechnology and using our knowledge around nanotechnology is to increase the strength to weight ratio of packaging. And we may also be able to customise gas and moisture barrier properties using nanoclays like bentonite and montmorillonite and plastic composites and slow down the loss of carbon dioxide from carbonated beverages. Now, up till the earthquake last Saturday, I was thinking, well, what a lot of use that would be, but at least the Coca-Cola or whatever I've got stored in my garage would stay there nice and fresh for a number of years, and I can wait 60,000 years until the next earthquake and have something to drink when the water supplies run out. And the other thing about these clay materials is that birds in the Amazon jungle, like these macaws, led by Richie, scaling the heights of improbability against the Aussies the other night, they eat these clays as a means of detoxifying their systems from the some of the toxic foods that they eat out of the jungle. So maybe they're good for us. Examples of active packaging, particularly nanosilver, that's really out there now. Freshbox is a registered trademark, I guess, or a registered name. It's used in antimicrobial food containers, and what they do is increase the shelf life of those tomatoes, so instead of something that goes mouldy within 2 weeks, you can have something that keeps beyond 2 weeks. And that's, again, that's based on nanosilver dispersed through the packaging material. Other examples are around food, such as sensors are based on DNA biochip or antigen technologies that could be used for detecting food shortage organisms, which would be nice, I suppose, if you're looking in your fridge and you decide, well, is this stuff off, give it a sniff, and as the usual home detection system. And if it smells off, you chuck it out, and if it doesn't smell off, you risk it. Usual consumer behaviour. Nanoscale RFID devices could be built into packaging to provide storage conditions and information and point of origin tracking. I guess one could question why you might need to do that. It's great for point of origin type concepts, but again, you'd end up with some interesting, I think, things happening if people start microwaving their food. And then somebody suddenly back in Woolworths Empire somewhere suddenly sees that somebody's pie has reached 150 degrees. Storage containers, refrigerators and kitchenware are other examples. There are many on the market now containing nanosilver for its antibacterial properties. Cleaning and sterilising agents, crockery and cutlery and cutting boards such as you can find on the internet. £23.95 for these small chopping boards. Things that are available out of the UK. Refrigerators contain nanosilver panels or components. Daiwoo, for example, advertises the refrigerator as proudly there as nanosilver. It contains an antibiotic deodorizer, which I suspect is probably the component that contains the nanosilver. So it's not likely to be in contact with the food. It's there to kill any bugs in the circulating air system. What are the implications for food safety? In terms of improvement in packaging properties, increasing the strength to weight ratio of packaging could has the potential to decrease plastic use. In terms of nanoclay plastic composites, the leaching of the clay components into the foods is a potential issue, I guess. People have started studying that and have seen that out of the sort of three metallic components like iron and aluminium that are in those clays, that only one or two of them will go into the food to any significant extent. So there may not be an issue there, but there certainly it needs to be looked at. And what about after disposal and disintegration in the environment? In terms of active packaging, the migration of active components into foods needs to be looked at. And again, is there the potential for antimicrobial or microbial resistance buildup? And that's the theme, I guess, of a Friends of the Earth report on nano and biocide of silver. Because nanosilver is used extensively in the medical arena. It's a potent antibacterial, great for wound treatment, what have you. And now we're just going to lead ourselves into the same situation as what we were with antibiotics, where we increase the resistance of bacteria through overuse of these antimicrobials. And that's the issue that Friends of the Earth have raised in their report. Will it just, extensive use, just negate the usefulness of these things in the medical arena? And again, with nanosensors, is there potential for the migration of these sensors into the food, out of the packaging? And again, what are the end of life and product disposal and environmental impact issues? Just now a wee bit about incremental versus disruptive food technologies. Disruptive food technologies are those that have a profound impact on the food industry and are incorporated kind of overnight, I guess, or in the context of the sort of extent of the history of food technology, maybe within 10 years, 5 to 10 years. One of those, of course, was the use of fire to cook food. It made mammoth much more tasty. Roller milling of wheat flour, when people switched from the old granite round millstones to the steel roller mills, virtually overnight the granite mills in the UK were abandoned. There are still these millstones lying around the paddocks of Wales and places like that where they used to mill them because the technology went out of existence basically overnight. Refrigeration and freezing. Pasteurisation and canning of food are again good examples of disruptive food technologies. And mechanical dough development, the high-speed development system used for producing bread in most New Zealand plant bakeries, is another good example, where the old bulk fermentation system of fermenting your dough like grandma used to for 6 to 12 hours went out of existence within about 10 years, apart from one or two bakeries, although it has made a bit of a comeback. So in the good old days, perhaps new was good, but now are people less willing to accept the new? And is that because the perceived benefits are less? Because consumers do rely on whether there is a perceived benefit for any particular technology. And then Jeff had a question about whether agri-food nanotechnology applications are likely to be disruptive or incremental. But it's my view that most of them will be incremental, and the reason for saying that is that most of them are currently downsizing currently accepted technologies, just like the computer industry has been doing for years. So what are the implications for New Zealand's food industry and consumers? The one is the need for life cycle analysis frameworks for nanotechnology in the agri-food chain. There needs to be a lot of work done about that. We currently, worldwide, there's a lot of attention being paid to life cycle analysis of issues like carbon and water footprints. And it's just starting to emerge now for nanotechnology. So at any point in the agri-food chain, what happens to these technologies, where do they end up, and what are the costs to us? In terms of regulatory and monitoring, there are challenges there, especially in relation to risk management. And we may not ever have the luxury of being able to define acceptable levels for some of these technologies. But we know one size fits all. And a good example of that is nano gold versus nano silver. Nano silver, as I mentioned, highly potent antimicrobial. Nano gold, no effects at all. Again, nano gold, no effects on things like zebrafish models that are used to look at cytotoxicity of some of these compounds, whereas nano silver has quite alarming properties in terms of the way that embryos and that are deformed in these animals. There's the potential for multinational and ingredient food manufacturers to bring the technologies into New Zealand, obviously through the back door, although our regulatory agencies, in theory, can look after us in that respect, because the legislation currently provides for examples where something new has to be taken through the regulatory system and given approval for. And we can ask the question about whether we actually do need nanotechnology in the food, agri-food chain. Do we need better shelf life? Would it lower food waste, for example, if we had better shelf life? Do we need better nutrient uptake? As I mentioned earlier, it could be a concern, particularly for feeding children with some of these foods. You could overdose them on their essential nutrients. Although it could be better for elderly people who require perhaps better nutrition, better uptake of some nutrients. There could be enormous gains for sustainable production of our foods if we can increase the impacts of fertilisers and pesticides and herbicides and lessen agricultural inputs. Farmers would love that. And what applications would we be happy with? And we're going to start exploring some of those issues in our social science program that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. And again, for any application, do the benefits outweigh the risks? This is the question that we have to ask ourselves. Thank you.